podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Anfield Wrap on Radio City Talk this week, and the initial plan for this week was for us to do a show entirely about books. We try to do that about this time of the year and have a good chat about sort of, you know, books that you could read around the pool, watching the sort of taking it easy over the summer. And we have got some authors coming up. We're going to be joined by Daniel Fieldsend, Mark Douglas, and by Michael Calvin to talk about their books, you know, which all sound very good indeed. But what I decided we had to do in this week was to talk about Liverpool's shocking, overstating it, surprising statement on the website about Virgil van Dijk and that transfer seemingly collapsing. I'm joined for this part of the show by John Gibbons before we get stuck into the books. And John, it's shocking is an overstatement, but it's the sort of thing which is unprecedented and which doesn't really reflect anyone at the club in a good light.
Yeah, it is very unprecedented, and I think that was why it was a bit of a surprise, because, you know, how often do you see a club do that? It's hardly ever. I mean, we as a football club seem to make quite a lot of statements regarding transfers in the summer, and lessons kind of don't seem to be learned, really. And it makes you kind of look at the club in a bit more detail and think, well, who's making decisions? Who's making decisions based on strategy? Who's making decisions based on, you know, how we go about getting a player and how we go about getting it on the line, and kind of what experience did you have, really? And you look around at Liverpool and this kind of highlights that it did just seem a little bit short in certain areas to me. You know, Jurgen Klopp's a fantastic football manager, and he's obviously decided that it would be a good idea for him to speak to the player directly, and we've heard that work in the past. You know, Fernando Torres gets the phone call on the beach, and it's Rafa Benitez, yeah, and he doesn't believe it, and things like that. So, nothing particularly new in terms of certain aspects, but something's gone badly wrong somewhere, and at some point, a football club's just gone, this isn't cricket. And you feel like you're looking at it going, it needs someone to go, well, actually, you know, can we do the, you know, we need to be kind of careful with this, and doesn't seem to be any thought of that gone in, and just kind of throwing our weight around in a way that we're not quite entitled you to, yeah. Do you know what I mean? We feel like we're back in the Champions League, that's great, but we're not quite Real Madrid. You feel like you just do whatever they want, you know what I mean? I mean, they got a transfer ban, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think that's I can't think what it is that they must have that's different from lots of other things, but there must be something, and there's something that's significant enough for Liverpool to behave the way in which they have. And I just think it's a ridiculous shame in that what it's done is, as you say, what it turns into is people worrying about what's going on at the football club more and wanting to know more about what's going on behind the scenes and know more about who's doing what. And what doesn't help is that they've given this transfer committee thing a name in the past. You know, the individuals on, and they're not very, you know, they very rarely, if ever, speak in public, which doesn't help in terms of garnering goodwill or anything like that. And so you're just left sort of wondering and thinking to yourselves, well, is this just a complete lack of competence, lads? And that's something that's a real shame off the back of the general sort of upbeat nature of the summer, the ideal nature of the summer after qualifying for the Champions League and then beating City and Chelsea seemingly to the signature of Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah, it is a real frustrating one, and as you say, it makes you kind of look at the football club. And ever since FSG have come in, there's a famous saying, isn't there, where if you don't know something about subjects, surround yourself with people who do. But the problem is, if you don't know enough about it, then how do you know the people who are bluffing you and the people who are really knowledgeable? And FSG have been caught out a few times over the years with people who are the former rather than the latter, really. And I think it also feels like a football club that if your face fits, you can get promoted very quickly. And this is all leading me on to Michael Edwards, who we don't know very little about because he tells us very little about himself. So you're having to kind of fill in the gaps a little bit. He's someone who is gathered a reputation as being someone who's quite good at analysing football, footballers using statistics. His record on that, I'd say, is indifferent, but I kind of don't really want to talk about that. I don't really want to talk about, you know, how good a signing Coutinho was and how good a signing Balotelli wasn't. You know, if that's what he's good at, then sound. If he's really, really good at it, give him some more money. How we've ended up in a situation where he's now negotiating on transfers because he's good at looking at some numbers on a computer and seeing how much someone's worth. I don't understand how that happens, and it feels like, you know, if at Liverpool, if someone thinks you're all right, then bloody hell, you go far. And I don't really understand how that can happen. And I think, for, you know, fair enough, if you had an ownership who really, really knew the football and thought he's a real bright talent and that's something, then that's fine. But I don't see who's there is to make these decisions to rapidly accelerate these people who don't have any experience. You know, if FSG have nothing to go on, then it should be, well, he's done that job somewhere else really, really well. And it wouldn't happen in any other industry. I don't think that you'd have someone, you know, at the top of the, you know, one of the top 10 teams in the world at what they do, suddenly just giving someone a go at a really important job because they quite like them and they're good at another job.
Yeah, I think again, this what doesn't help in this is the fact that again, it's all done shrouded in darkness, and it's all done where these people don't speak, or if they do speak, they don't speak very often. You know, you've got you know Michael Gordon, and you've got Mike Edwards here, and neither of them aren't prominent in terms of, you know, who they are as people, and sort of giving you some insight into what it is that does qualify them, and all that'd be fine if it was going swimmingly, at which point you can go, well, you know, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, and it's all just sort of going swimmingly all the time, whereas it's not. It clearly isn't. Liverpool had a good summer last summer, and people should be impressed with that, and should think that they've done a good job there. But it does seem as though when the pressure's come back on here, they have fallen short. And I'd love not to have to think about this stuff. And I think that's sort of what you're saying as well. You'd love to sort of be able to go, well, let's just let them get on with that, and we just get on with paying through the gate and just watching the football team and just going from there. When you have to make statements like that on your official website, that you can't even do them privately, but when they've got to be that sort of that blatant, that's when you've got a problem.
Yeah. Because for Michael Edwards, it's his first summer in a new job and the first transfer, you know, first proper transfer. You know, they've managed to persuade Solanke, okay, great, he looks a decent young player, but the first proper transfer, the one they've really gone at to, and it's another moment where it feels like the managers end up getting hung to dry a little bit as well, and that's been something that's happened quite a lot under FSG as well. You look at the, you know, Kenny Dalglish over the Suarez stuff, and you could say that some of his actions are misguided, but, you know, he was a football manager and Kenny Dalglish will always have Liverpool's back. It's one of the most wonderful things about him. But where was anyone else going, do you know what, Kenny, maybe we shouldn't do that, or maybe we should approach this in a different way, you know, and it felt like that. You know, Rodgers felt like he was the spokesman for the whole football club sometimes, when, you know, he probably would have been better off as a young manager just coaching a bit. And so it can be kind of a bit frustrating, really, that you know, there aren't more strong individuals within the football club who are kind of willing to take things on. You know, I feel a bit sorry for Peter Moore because he's just come in. He probably feels like he won't mind getting his feet under the desk for a bit, and then he's suddenly got this to deal with that kind of isn't really kind of anything to do with him. And so it's just a real mess. Look, we might end up still having a good summer. You know, we shouldn't...
There's every chance.
You know, we might buy... I don't think we'll get Van Dijk now, but, you know, we will buy a centre-half, and maybe he'll turn out to be a better player, maybe he'll do really well. You kind of don't know, you know, you just have to kind of wait and see, but it's frustrating, and it's a little bit amateurish as well, and that's kind of annoying when there was so much kind of positivity around the football club, you know, in terms of how we finished the season, you know, having fun going over to Australia and things like that, and then everyone was going off on holiday, and you think, well, we're getting linked with some good players here, and then it's just another little kind of thing where you start to doubt where the direction the football club's going.
Okay, this is the Anfield Wrap on Radio City Talk. Just wanted to cover that. We're going to go to a break now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Mark Douglas, and then, as I say, we've got more excellent interviews around books to come, and more coverage of what's going on with Virgil van Dijk on theanfieldwrap.com. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the Anfield Wrap on Radio City Talk. I'm really pleased to have someone from the City who's written a fabulous book called The European Game, The Secret to European Football Success. It's Dan Fieldsend. And Dan, let's start with your story a little bit. Really, it's that you're a UEFA qualified coach. You've scouted for Liverpool. You've been working in the football industry, and then you decided to go around Europe's premier training grounds and write down what you learnt about the way in which they go about their business.
Yeah, that was always just a personal indulgence of sorts. I always wanted to travel around and visit these clubs. It's what we have in England. It's the global league. It is. If you look at Liverpool's youth academy, Alex Inglethorpe's in charge. He's a brilliant, inspirational fella. And he studied his thesis on Ajax in the Dutch way.
Yeah.
And then you've got Pep Linders, who's that bridge. Yeah. We got him from Porto. You know, he's well-versed in the Portuguese way of doing things. And obviously we've got Jürgen Klopp, a German manager. But it's not just Liverpool. All clubs in the Premier League are like that. It's a real globalised league. And what I wanted to investigate was, with these clubs where we're getting these guys from, did they still keep their cultural uniqueness? Or was football continental-wise, you know, an amalgamation of sameness?
Well, you've ended up going to Ajax, Juventus, Benfica, Bayern Munich, AC Milan, Lyon, Atletico Bilbao, plus others, and had a good look around. And I'm not going to ask you to go, well, what was the answer? But did you notice sort of quite disparate sort of cultural factors in play?
Yeah, what I found was there's this term, psychogeography, And it's how a place and the people shape institutions within that environment. So if we use Athletic Bilbao as an example, you know about the Cantera policy that they've got there. So for people who don't know, every player who plays for Athletic Bilbao has to have ties to a localised Basque region. So if we put it in the context of Liverpool, you know, it's having a Scouse 11, which is the dream, of course. But things like that, them kinds of cultural traits are really quite... I'm trying to think of the way to describe it. They've attained, they're utilised.
They become embedded in the way the club wants to do what it wants to do.
Yeah. And what we have here, we have very we have disparities in the styles that are used at different Premier League clubs. Whereas on the continent, it's kind of like national schools of thought. You have the Dutch way, you know, you have the Spanish way, the German way, the Portuguese way. And you look at the successful nations, you know, they do retain that identity, whereas in England, Premier League clubs with various agendas and what have you, it doesn't reflect the national team.
Is there, you mentioned there, I mean, a book I've always loved, and I think you've cited it here, and you're getting towards it as well, David Winner's Brilliant Orange on Dutch football, and how it is like this whole mentality, almost set of neuroses feed in. And you mentioned geography as well. Geography, he cites that idea of psychic geography in there. And then you mentioned that it didn't happen. It doesn't happen in the same way in England. And I've always been fascinated by this as to why that's never quite happened. And I wondered if it's because, you know, when English football was predominant in the continent from, say, 75 to 85, there wasn't the same sort of... It wasn't at the heart of the national sort of game and the national consciousness. It wasn't like... You know, it wasn't like this is everything. So what Paisley and Clough and Greenwood were all doing just sort of became, oh, well, it's just a bit of footy. Whereas, you know, you look abroad and you mention Bilbao, it's at the centre of the culture. And you mention Porto, and it's at the centre of the culture. Is that what you found as well? It's everywhere you go. And we get that in Liverpool, but across the rest of England, that's often just not the case.
Yeah. I'm 1990 born, so I wasn't alive in the Greenwood days. It was my generation that kind of watched the sunset on mystery in football. In the sense that, you know, we used to look abroad and you'd look at names like Bayern Munich and Ajax, and there was that kind of mystery associated with them, which my generation's watched that fade. In regards to what you're saying there, though, yes, if you go to Bilbao, for example, you go to Bilbao and there are Athletic flags hanging from every washing line and balcony, and it's that cup final atmosphere, but that's all year round. You know, and it is like that throughout most of Europe. You're definitely touching on something there.
And you've within the book, you've got a fair few Liverpool connections. And interesting stuff at the moment. I noticed you do a little bit on Red Bull Leipzig, which is interesting at the moment when people are talking about Naby Keita. Mm. You've got bits in there with Xabi Alonso knocking around as well. There's something to grab people in here.
Yeah, it relates to Liverpool a few times. When I went to Milan, I met with Filippo Galli, who's this incredible man. You know, he's won 3 European Cups. He played with Baresi, Maldini. He's royalty in football. And he says to me, so you're Scouse, you're from Liverpool? I say, yeah. He says, I can't explain to you how much I love Liverpool FC. He said, it's in my veins. And I'm looking at this man thinking, oh my God, you know, you've won everything. And he goes on, and within 7 seconds, he's named everyone who started that 84 Cup final. He's going, Grobler, Neil, and he's just listing through them. And obviously, when you're within Liverpool, you know how big the club is, you know, because it's overwhelming. But it's only when you travel around and you're sitting in places like Prague and what have you, and people just want to talk about Liverpool Football Club, it's when you come to realise how actually massive the club is. You know, you said Xabi Alonso as well there. So I went to Sabre Strasse, which is their training ground, which is like this most unbelievably liberal place in that.
You just walk around,
the fans grab. You've been, haven't you?
John and Andy went to speak to Xabi, and they couldn't believe that how laid back the training ground was.
Yeah, you just grab a bevy and the fans are all stood there, which you can't imagine happening here in any Premier League team. And stood there, and obviously you get a little bit excited. I shout down to Xabi Alonso, I shout, Xabi, are you coming back to Liverpool? Obviously not knowing he was about to retire. And the fans are laughing. He walks down and he comes up and he says, I recognise that accent, lad. And I'm thinking, oh, Xabi.
he got you there.
Yeah, you magnificent man.
Right the way through, you also do a lot of work on Rayo as well, which is dead interesting. I mean, you didn't pick the obvious clubs, and it is, you know, it seems quite clear from talking to you separately, and also from what's in the book, that you were looking for culturally interesting things. It wasn't just the idea of what, how many super clubs can we cram in here? How many European institutions can we cram in? You know, you spend a lot of time in the book sort of dwelling on sides like Rayo and Red Bull Leipzig and things like that. It's you're trying to track the pathways going forward in football, not just sort of looking at how these clubs have got to where they are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I was just visit all of the, just put Juventus, just put Bayern Munich. I mean, they're in there as well. But for point of comparison, there's Budapest Honved in there, you know, who are historically this great team. But with the fall of communism and football there is really, well, disintegrated. And they're a good point in comparison, you know. There's other teams as well. There's Austria-Vienna. And then you go from Austria-Vienna to Bayern Munich and you can compare the methods that they use at one club, how they transfer to other clubs, you know.
And in there as well, I mean, he keeps coming back in lots of different things that I've been reading at the minute, is Rangnick. Yeah. You spend a lot of time working sort of and wondering about what Rangnick's influence in general in German football. And he seems to be a figure who, you know, he comes up in Das Reboot by Raphael Honigstein as well. He's a figure that grabs a lot of the sort of the German consciousness around the game at the moment.
Yeah, he's quite a pioneer, to be honest. I spoke to several guys and he said he appeared on television the late 90s. And he's got a tactics board and he's talking about tactics and the fans were in uproar in Germany, you know, and they're saying, football's such a simple game, why are you trying to make it like this? Which is, there's a lot of parallels there with what it used to be like in England a few years back. Obviously, I think Gary Neville's came in and he's revolutionised consciousness a little bit. But Ralf Rangnick did that in Germany. And people might not know about his managerial career, but what he's been doing at Red Bull, the rise there, you could attribute it all down to him. Most definitely.
Okay. So the book is out now, and it is on, it's Arena Sport. It's available on, out on Amazon.
Amazon, Waterstones, yeah.
Yeah, out on Amazon, published on the 8th of June. So as you're listening to this, it will be out and available. Amazon, Waterstones, all the obvious places. The European Game by Daniel Fieldsend. This is the Anfield Wrap on Radio City Talk. Thank you very much for Daniel for coming in. And we will step over and get ourselves involved in yet another book. Just trying to box off your summer reading around the pool. That's all I'm trying to do for you, you know.
You know, a guy who gives his heart and soul to a football club, and he's done that at Newcastle. And I think people of Newcastle have kind of appreciated that. And it's been a really kind of uplifting season at Newcastle. I think Rafa's got to take so much of the credit for that.
Well, we'll come on to the season as a whole in a second, but just that sort of start that you know, where you start from there, it is that feeling of that, you know, Benitez himself, you feel as though he wants to feel a sense of belonging, that he is understanding of football. I think because of the disparate nature of his character, that he's so, in many ways, you know, he's so single-minded about the game of football on the one hand, and that he's notoriously or reputed to be colder with players than many managers and all of that sort of stuff on the one hand. But on the other hand, he does come across very much as a man who feels the character and the culture of football really quite keenly. There was, you know, before he came to Liverpool, he was crying at his press conference leaving Valencia. You know, there's been images of him in tears at a service to do with Hillsborough at Liverpool. That he's got these two sides to him. One's deeply and intensely emotional, and maybe that partially explains why there's this other side to him that almost tries to block all that out and instead is very analytical. And he does need that, doesn't he? He needs to feed both sides of that personality.
Absolutely, yeah, that is absolutely spot on. We kind of chatted about it at the end of the season, where there was, you know, the final day of the season in Newcastle, and it was a really kind of you saw an emotional side to Rafa in the final two games that you maybe hadn't seen since January, when things had got a little bit tense. And I think you could see that kind of icy sort of side, you know, the quite ruthless side of Rafa sort of came out between January and about March. But at the end of the season, you saw this really emotional side of Rafa. And we kind of sat down for a drink at the end of the season and we said, what's really interesting with Rafa is, I mean, especially in Newcastle this season, he has been quite emotional. I think he's actually a warm character towards the players. I mean, he was very warm, I know, towards the supporters, and there was that real bond with the supporters of Liverpool from the start. I think that was always there. But I think the players will tell you he's a warmer character. He's kind of a funnier kind of character than he was maybe when he was at Liverpool. But the football is actually quite cold and calculating when it needs to be. Newcastle had some injuries in the heart of the winter, and we saw for Rafa, he really made the team quite functional. Yeah, they were quite direct. They were they played to their strengths, and I think he got a bit of criticism at the time from a lot of other supporters in the Championship, who saying, "Oh, you know, you've got all these," but Rafa knows. You know, there's that kind of this theme that's gone through the season that we've not had at Newcastle for so long, and people just basically say, "Look, Rafa knows. Don't worry about it. He's got it. He knows what he's doing." And you know, what's been really interesting, what I can try to get across in the book was, you know, when people say Rafa knows, it's not this kind of faith, this blind faith you've got in the guy. It's a guy who didn't take a holiday last summer. He has not taken a holiday this summer either. But the amount of hours that he puts into it and his backroom team put into it, you kind of feel like he can be emotional because he's done the hard work. You know, he doesn't need the reason the fans have so much emotion for him is they feel that he cares about that football club as much as they do.
Yeah.
And it was the same at Liverpool, because you knew that. You knew when he was at Liverpool, the reason why maybe sometimes, you know, people kind of from the outside didn't like him, because he was going into bat for that football club more than anybody else. He kind of felt it like a supporter. He doesn't, you know, he wasn't as knee-jerk as fan, but he felt it. And we get that feeling in Newcastle, and you see it from time and time again, the things that he says and the things that he does when he's at a football club that really cares about him. He's the bat for that football club, and he gives everything, you know.
He does a day's work. I mean, you know, it sounds like a trite thing to say, but, you know, I think that cities like Liverpool and Newcastle respect people who are committed to a cause and who do a proper day's work, and not just one day's work. But in the case of Benitez, you're right to point out, you know, this is a man who will gladly go without a holiday if he thinks it's going to help his football club succeed.
Completely, yeah. I mean, what I found really, really interesting with Rafa was the kind of the scope of the amount of work that he put in, you know. And he didn't feel like, I mean, he's got this obsessiveness about him that is really kind of fascinating. And we found in press conferences, and I sort of go into it a little bit in the book, you know, he kind of, we have Alan Pardew before, who, you know, Alan Pardew is a, you know, not a bad manager. I mean, I didn't think, you know, warm to him that much. But I think with Alan Pardew, you know, it wasn't that he wasn't working hard, but I got the impression with Alan Pardew, he was doing things deliberately. He was doing things to kind of come across as if things were a certain way. So he was saying things in order to try and win the fans round with Rafa. With Rafa, there's this authenticity there. You know, in January, where it looked as if, you know, people were worried about, was he going to walk out? The stuff that he was saying came from a position where, you know, you knew that he's a very authentic guy. And when, you know, when he says something, the fans listen to him at Newcastle because they know he's the first person who's come in. And, you know, at the end of the season, we know he would have walked away if he hadn't got what he wanted. And the fact that he's got that, I don't know what the best way to say. I think authority is the right way to say it. But because, you know, he does everything. He doesn't expect any player to do something that he wouldn't do. You know, the guy's coming in at 7 o'clock. In the course of the book, we kind of detail the fact that he in the evening, like he was asked at one point, you know, well, you know, why don't you go home before 10? He's like, well, my family are all in the Wirral, and there's games I want to watch on TV, so I just sit in the training ground and watch these games. You're sort of thinking, this is a guy who's like, you know, he's like, well, when I lived in Liverpool, you know, I had to go home and take my work home with me. But here, you know, my family are here. I could just work at the training ground till 10 o'clock. And you're thinking, to him, it's just normal.
Yeah.
And you have to have so much admiration for a guy like that because, you know, I say at the end, he handled it really well. But at the end, I talk about the impact of what would have happened if Newcastle hadn't got. He felt that, you know, he knew. He was in the meetings at the start of the season where they said, look, you know, the football club, if we don't go up, we're kind of putting a lot of money into this staying up. You know, we're growing the largest wage bill in the Championship history. And Rafa, you know, he wasn't just doing it for his own good. He was doing it because he knew that if Newcastle didn't go up this season, they would have been in a lot of trouble and the football club would have gone down a kind of very different route next season. I think at the end of the season, he celebrated so much at Newcastle because he knew he was doing something for that football club. It was about, if we fail, it's not my CV looks bad. It's these people have taken me to the heart. I will have failed them. A football club will go through a bad patch because of what I've done. And I just appreciated that with Rafa. And I think a lot of the fans did that. You know, he wasn't doing it for himself. It wasn't about his CV. It was about, you know, signing up to a project and following it through.
Well, on that then, you know, getting towards the end of the season, there's one game that stands out for me in my mind because I watched it live and I saw a few Newcastle games live last season, but the one that stands out is that away game at Brighton and Hove Albion. And before I let you go, Mark, I just, you know, looking at that game, to me it was both the strength of Benitez in a weird little way, an odd weakness. It showed the fickleness of football with the crazy equalising goal. Yeah. But it was a game where, you know, in an intense run of fixtures at that time, I think Newcastle had just got themselves a result against Huddersfield or had Huddersfield next. And they'd had Bristol City around the same time, who were in a good place then. But they got the results away at Huddersfield and away at Brighton back-to-back. And I just sort of remember feeling that was remarkably Benitez. And that Brighton game, you know, Newcastle deserved all 3 points. Forget the nature of the equalising goal. Newcastle spent the 90 minutes, looked the superior side to me, almost all points of the game. And it showed, didn't it, the quality of the Newcastle side. And, you know, they end up on the final day getting the championship. But, you know, there was a strength in depth there and a work ethic and a plan that deserved all of that. And I'm sure that comes over in the book.
Yeah, completely. I think what's really interesting is that we saw from it that everything that he did at the start of the season was to kind of put in place these little building blocks to improve the mentality of the players. And, you know, we got through previous two seasons at Newcastle where they hadn't won, they only won away games, maybe two or three.
Yeah.
And regularly, the thing that he felt needed to be practiced was a mentality thing. There's a great quote from him where he says, where he's asked why, you know, they were better away from him. And basically, you know, any team can run, any team can sort of, you know, we can set up any team. Every team, even in our division, especially in the Premier League, has quality. But it was the mentality that he wanted. And I think at Brighton, what was really interesting, he came up with a game plan, but they kept going. And it was 89 minutes where Ryan Perez saw that goal. And previous Newcastle teams wouldn't have been able to do that. They would have come back from one behind for a start. And then they wouldn't have kept going. They wouldn't have kept going and kept following the plan of the manager. You know, you saw, especially in the Huddersfield game, I think even more so, they had a plan. You know, good players like your Jonjo Shelvey's, your kind of Isaac Haynes, even your Dwight Gales, they were prepared to kind of give up their own glory to play into this kind of Rafa Benitez game plan, which you would have seen in Liverpool.
Yeah.
How many away nights in Europe did you have in Liverpool where really good players were sort of doing their bit for the team? And it was almost like, you know, everybody talks about Istanbul, but that was a triumph of a team that collectively was way better than the sum of its parts. And I think we saw that with Newcastle at times last season where people thought that individually they were really, really good. But actually, towards the end of the season, they had to be collectively really, really good. And that's what Rafa was all about. You know, that's what, and that's the book's kind of a little bit about. You see in the summary, you know, he brings in players who've got, you know, really good backstories. Guys like Matt Ritchie, who went to play at Dagenham, played at Portsmouth, played at these games, and came through the ranks. And Dwight Gale played at Bishop Stortford when he was a kid, you know, going on the back of the bus to Harrogate when he was doing kind of, you know, he's a part-time carpenter as well. And you've got these guys who, you know, they can't believe they're working with Rafa Benitez, even though they kind of had their own, you know, great careers themselves. And I think it was just such a good mix that he saw, that Rafa sort of saw that he needed good characters, but he also needed them to be able to have the ability to kind of want to work with him and to know that, look, we're Newcastle United in the Championship. Everybody expects us to walk through this division. It's not going to be that easy. You've got to be prepared to do the hard work. I'm prepared to do the hard work. You know, he says in the book, you know, I approached kind of Burton like I did Barcelona because,
yeah,
you know, if you think you're too good for Burton, then they will beat you. And it was kind of like, you know, you sort of thought, this is so refreshing from a guy who's probably got the best CV of any manager in the Championship, and certainly, you know, almost as good as most in the Premier League as well. So, you know, it was a really uplifting scene. It's been great to be able to kind of write the book and give it a bit of a, you know, give it a bit of an uplifting sort of positive end as well, because we haven't had many of them at Newcastle.
well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. So it's called Inside the Raffolution. It's on Sport Media. We'll tweet out links, yep, and things. It's out on the on June the 15th, but you can, yep, pre-order it now on Amazon, and it's £10 at the moment. And so, yep, you can get hold of a copy of that, Inside the Raffolution with Mark Douglas. This is the Anfield Wrap on Radio City Talk. We're going to give you more books to read by the beach in a second. Don't go anywhere.
Yeah, ironically enough, now worked in football. He's a European scout at Norwich City. I remember him going through the system, and he was bright enough at 16 to know he wasn't quite going to make it. You know, he did everything, he captained the county and all that stuff, but wasn't quite good enough. Went into coaching, did his degree in performance analysis, and went from there. Most kids are still sort of tied into that dream. And it's very difficult to watch them come to terms with failure. So, for instance, with my son, the thing that always stayed with me was one night, it was a Thursday night, and it was in the under-14s there at League Two Academy, and one of the boys from his group was released on that particular night. We happened to walk across the car park, and I saw the father and son in the car. The father was in the front seat, and he was obviously animated and quite angry. And the boy was in the back seat, looking out of the window, and his face was frozen in this silent scream, and it stayed with me. And that's probably why that image has driven me to try and get beneath the skin of what is a huge issue.
Well, I mean, there's the general issue, and we'll maybe come on to that with the nature of the money now and the impact of the grandiosity, but also just simple stuff around, you know, I think you've got Tony McCool in there who at one point sort of says, you know, the way you're talking to that child is horrendous. And he goes on to detail this story of a side he was working with playing in Belgium, and basically he gets, you know, he just gets undone a little bit, this lad playing left back. He plays the ball into midfield. They've seen it coming, the clever footballers, they nick it, they've done it, and they go on and they score. And the coach screams at him over and over again, get off the pitch, get off the pitch, get off the pitch, and just completely demolishes this child, this left back. And a lot of, so many of the stories that you've got in there, the tales of this is, you know, the intent, the fact that these were putting effectively children through, I think we all accept that football clubs are to some degree an emotional hothouse, but we're putting children through these emotional hothouses. And when I read that just that anecdote within the book, it really stayed with me, to be honest with you, Mike. And I was, you know, just thinking, what a terrible thing to go through, that this lad who wasn't going to, almost certainly not going to be kept on anyway, I think Tony says, but that he has that experience, and he has to take that away with him for the rest of his life, just demolishes him.
Well, you know, several things in that, Neil. The first is that one of the things that coach screamed was, get off my pitch.
Yeah.
How about that for arrogance and just sheer destructiveness? When Tony went to see that boy who was sobbing behind the goal, you know, there's another aspect of the book where I look at a boy called Kieran Bywater, who'd been released very unexpectedly by West Ham, had been their Academy Player of the Year, he was captain in the under-21s, 23s, just came out of nowhere, and he went to about seven different clubs on trial, and in the end he just broke down, almost had a nervous breakdown, and he walked off the pitch after 15 minutes saying, I can't do this anymore. And 2 weeks ago, I was playing against PSV Eindhoven. Now here am I on this park pitch trying to impress some guys from a League Two club. Just couldn't handle it. Now, there's a happy ending to that story because he became involved. There's an organisation called the Plus Trust, which offer independent advice, confidential advice to parents and children. And they fixed him up, and he's going at college in the States, doing very, very well, and, you know, has got ambitions of getting into the MLS. So, you know, that's the happiness. I think, as I said, that what I was driven by with this was, look, it's a simple question, really. What's the game doing to our kids? And is it worth the fractured families that you see, the blighted lives? And does football fulfil its duty of care? You know, not just to the vulnerable children, but also to their parents, who've got every right to be concerned, because, you know, they go into it with unconditional love, and sometimes that can spill over in dangerous areas, because I have seen parents living their lives vicariously through their kids' development of football. But, you know, the numbers are just so daunting that you look at it. You know, the stat that I use most of all from the book is that only 180 of the 1.5 million boys who play organised football, youth football, at any one time in England, will become a Premier League pro. Now, the success rate of that is 0.012%, which is pretty much the chances of you getting hit by a meteorite next time you're walking down Anfield Road. You know, it's infinitesimal. You know, less than 1% of the boys who enter an academy at the age of 9 will make it or make a living from the game. Now, that's semi-upwards. So the dropout rate is terrifying, and that begs another massive question, which is who picks up the pieces? And it's all very well to say from an adult perspective, oh, well, you know, at least you've had a good shot at it. You know, you've had good coaching, but, you know, failure is part of life. You know, it's a ruthless world. Well, that's looking at it from an adult perspective. Let's turn it around on its head. Look at it from a child. That child has had that dream developed from the age of 6. In fact, it's happening earlier now. If you take as an example, there's a race to the bottom going on where you've got kids 3 and 4 years old being approached by scouts. To give you another example, there's a lad called Jackson Lau who was in Manchester. His mum posted a YouTube video of him kicking a football around in his back garden with his 5-year-old brother. Thing you know, they get a knock on the door from Manchester City Scout. Next thing you know, he's in the Manchester Evening News. He's posing with his... he's got a Messi shirt on, a Barcelona shirt, which basically reaches past his knees. It's just an absurd spectacle. It's absurd because Jason Ladd is 3 years old. Now, and his mum's, parroting on about, oh, you know, I really hope both he and his brother make it as professional footballers at 3 years old. Where are we going with that? You've got 6-year-olds being released from academies, and I quote here, for picking up bad habits. You've got 11-year-olds who basically are told they're failures. You've got some kids who are detached from their home environment, so they might sign for a Premier League academy, a relocation package to turn up. Now, it might be that, in fact, the probability is that, you know, when they're 13, 14, that will be it. They'll be released. Then what do they do then? They go back to where they came from. And, I've spoken to parents and kids. When they're released from a football club, there is such a level of almost glee that they hadn't made it. You used to be at City, United, Liverpool, Everton, wherever it is. You used to be. So in other words, you're telling a 13-year-old, well, I'm sorry, son, but your future is behind you. Now, you know, what effect does that have? And I just think that there are some really good coaches out there, some enlightened strategies being pursued. But bottom line is that football basically treat young boys as if they're tender pieces of meat. And I can't stand that.
It's right the way through. As you get towards the end of the book, you begin to close on the England under 17 side. And there, for instance, I mean, that you just to give a bit of sort of contemporary resonance there, you mentioned Solanke, Liverpool's new sign, and you mentioned Joe Gomez for that matter, you know. But one of the things that struck me with that was on Solanke, what you actually say is, you know, that there's even there, he's come right the way through the ranks, achieved everything he's achieved, but now he's this sort of commodity in some sort of game around FFP. There's the, you're raising up there, that base. Basically, there's football bodies are trying to put structures in place. There's the new academisation rules, and that what it leads to is it leads to clubs cynically acting as corporations often do within the rules, but simultaneously pushing the rules to their absolute limit and within their own interests. And what that's done is that in many senses that's deepened the cynicism around, to use your words, treating these young men and young boys going right the way down to the ages of 6 to 9 especially as pieces of meat, that no one wants to lose out on one, that the risk reward becomes all over the place, and that's just increasingly sort of deepening the dehumanisation towards these young men.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what we have a situation where, you know, boys are if you take as an example Gareth Southgate, who I think comes across very, very well in the book.
Yeah.
Now, he says, look, I can't tell you whether a kid in our England under-16 team is going to make a career in the game. So how on earth can you say, and people tell me, that you can say, oh, yeah, so little Johnny's going to be a pro at when he's 6 years old. You can tell that. It's nonsense. But what is happening, and you hit the nail on the head there, Neil, is that they're... Football is driven by fear and insecurity, and the whole system, the numbers game, the trawling of kids, the stacking of kids by the bigger clubs, all that goes down back to the fact that no one wants to be the man who failed to sign the Beatles,
yep.
in football terms. You know, they don't want to miss out on the chosen one. They don't want to miss out on a Steven Gerrard or whoever. Now, because of that, corners are cut. And there's a black economy built up around that. It's under-regulated. So you have agents. In essence, surprise, surprise, FIFA has sold shirts yet again. They decided that agents was too hard an area to govern. So they then passed the buck to the FAs, but basically said, well, look, I know we used to have this system whereby we had the exams, and now you or I, Neil, can pay 500 quid and we're agents tomorrow. Now, you see them all around the place. The local term for them is plant pots, and they're the ones just pestering kids and their parents on touchlines. I've seen complicit parents smuggle these guys into training grounds. I've seen these guys offer cinema tickets to boys as little tokens of favour. Now, I'm sorry, but that is grooming by any other name. And that is wrong. I've got some sympathy. I think the Premier League's elite performance plan, the strategy, I think is desperately flawed. Huge amounts of money have been spent on it already, 400 million out of the 400 million coming in. Something like a Steve Pye will say, look, just let them play.
Yeah.
Put two jumpers down as goalposts. And that creates a natural football, and now it's all robotic. And, you get the ball, you receive it on half turn, give, pass, receive, whole thing is most prescriptive. So that's playing point of view is having a bad effect. But what's it having on just a basic human level? What we've got is football is notorious for abusing the power of opportunity. And if you've got... I'll give you a good example of this, which was actually given to me by someone who actually did what many people thought was a terrible thing. A guy called Phil Giles, who's the co-director of football at Brentford. He closed his academy and was done horrendously badly. You had under-18s being paraded around Griffin Park with the full knowledge of the club that the contracts that these boys had just signed were worthless because they were going to close it down. But he's come into it from a different world, an analytic world. And he made the point, which I think is a really important point. Look, imagine the moral outcry if the banks started recruiting boys as young as nine, training them up, doing foreign exchange or whatever it is, and then trading them between each other before adolescence hit. Now, that's the reality of youth football today. And where we are with it is that I think there's no education process for the parents. They need help. And I think excesses that are excused simply because of football's prominence and celebrity say as much about us as parents or participants or supporters or media observers as they do about the game itself. And, I think just things have to change. Cherish that dream and celebrate achievement because it is a heck of an achievement to actually... make it through the mill, as it were. But let's protect the innocent. And I don't know whether that's been done at the moment.
Okay. I think you've got a flavour of the book there. I'll talk for a minute because Mike's far too modest. It is off the back of the Nowhere Men, followed by Proud, followed by Living on the Volcano, and I know he worked with Joey Barton as a co-writer, as he prefers to refer to it as, on No Nonsense. He is probably the UK's most accomplished writer about football in the general sense in the country at the moment. Don't interrupt, Mike, and don't tell me there's someone else in the sense of dealing with long-form books such as this one. Can't recommend it highly enough. It is, for those of us who are interested in the game wider, as I'd like to think think a lot of the people who listen to the Anfield Rap, wider than just our clubs, but about sort of the game in terms of what it actually does to people and how we communicate within that, is another great example of his work. So it's available now, it's out now, it's called No Hunger in Paradise, Michael Calvin. It really is groundbreaking, excellent, truly tremendous stuff. I'd like to thank him for coming on the Anfield Rap. I'll hopefully speak to him further about it in the next few weeks and months. But that's the Anfield Rap this week on Radio City Talk. Thank you very much to everyone who's contributed and people who've taken the time to write these wonderful books about football. We'll be back with more of this sort of stuff next week. Sports Social Podcast Network.